John Hockenberry here. Thank you for downloading this podcast from WNYC and Public Radio International. You're a very discriminating person, I can tell that. Remember, we're as keen to hear from you as we are from John in Dallas or Joan in Eugene. You can follow us on Twitter at The Takeaway and find out more at thetakeaway.org. Here then, for your listening pleasure, is The Takeaway Podcast. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And one simple bike ride, that's what we're talking about today. One simple bike ride threatening the health of a community. Can a simple high school football game threaten to inject undue pressure into a high school? And we look at the pressure building in the key Senate race in the state of Kentucky. Todd Zwillick spends some time in horse country and in urban Kentucky. But first, a word about that healthy bike ride, one that's been a challenge to public health officials.
You woke up and you weren't dry.
Is
that the neck you guys do often?
We do, yes. Thank you, guys. I have to go speak with the health department now.
Sound of a crowd of reporters following Casey Hickox out the door as she and her boyfriend headed out on a bike ride through the Maine woods. There's likely to be a legal fight ahead about Casey's choice since she's supposedly quarantined, but was her decision unethical? Arthur Kaplan, head of the Division of Medical Ethics at the NYU Langone Medical Center, joins me now. Art, this bike ride here, harmless but controversial at the same time. Is that fair?
I think it's fair. If it was harmful, she probably just wiped out about half the American press corps because they were within 3 feet of her and some I saw touch her. So, you know, if you believe some, that was something that should lead to all of them in moon suits.
But even touching her.
Even under strict quarantine,
yeah.
You can jog, you can bike ride, right. You can come out. There's no airborne risk here. So the bike ride, healthy for her. No risk to anybody.
Although she is not helping anyone by creating this controversy, local authorities are pursuing a court order to enforce her quarantine. She talked to the health department, so she clearly knows that she's defying authority on some level. What do you make of that?
Well, you know, she's got a case. I think if the governor of Maine goes to court, he's going to lose. The way quarantine works, strict quarantine confinement, is you're supposed to use the least possible invasive alternative, the thing that restricts your liberty the least. Mm-hmm. He can put her, you know, she can just say, I'm going to monitor myself. If I get symptoms, then I'll be infectious. Otherwise, leave me alone. And I think the court will be persuaded. I don't think the state's going to win this. But that aside, she's clearly freaking people out. People are nervous. There's a lot of public panic out there. The governors, by screaming about quarantine, aren't helping that because it makes it sound
right,
you know, you got to lock her up or she's going to be Typhoid Mary. Still, voluntary isolation, monitor yourself, that would be the right strategy for anybody who's been exposed to someone with Ebola.
Part of my gut says, you know, why do this, Casey? You know, just stay home and wait it out. But part of me says, you know, we're right back in the AIDS days. You know,
and
it's just all about this crazy fear and parents saying, I don't want my kids going to school with other kids. And
I'm not
living next
door to you.
She's right to push this, maybe.
Well, there is. We're certainly back in the AIDS days, the panic days of AIDS when everybody wondered, can I drink coffee from the same cup? Can you send your kid to school with me? All the worries and concerns when we didn't really believe what the experts said, that you could only get it by sex. It was another one of these body fluid exchange things, like Ebola. I understand why she's got her position. I really do. But I think it would be easier if she kept having a press conference from her house saying, I'm not infectious. Anyone who wants to come in here, you're welcome to come visit me. I'll talk to whoever comes. You know, we got off on the whole wrong foot here. We should treat these people, the healthcare workers, who are, by the way, the people at real risk because they are exposed to the fluids. We should treat them like heroes and basically put them in an R&R respite situation. You know, let's get them take out and do everything that can make a pleasant 3-week vacation for them. Pay them.
Here's Dr. Anthony Fauci, who's basically the chief healthcare public health authority in the United States right now. He's been with the National Institute of Health for a long, long time. Here's Fauci speaking about this.
I don't fault those who feel that a quarantine is necessary because I think they're acting in good faith. The only thing is I don't think it's based on what we know about the scientific data.
And, you know, the kind of people who are healthcare workers in a place like West Africa, they're going to be tough. they're going to be renegades. They're going to be people who defy authority. They're going to be risk takers. But I don't think they're necessarily going to be taking risks with other people's lives. So maybe we should give her the benefit of the doubt here.
Well, they're certainly not going to be taking risks with other people's lives. That's what led them to the hellhole that is West Africa these days, with collapsing hospital systems and serious chances of getting Ebola because so many people are infected. The other thing to keep in mind is they're not going to lie about their own status because they've seen Ebola. So they're going to be first, you know, going at rocket speed to get to a hospital if they show any signs of infection. Treat them like heroes. Set up a vacation kind of situation. And then let's get a consistent message here. You know, you hear the Army say we're quarantining everybody. The governors are screaming we have to quarantine in many states. The White House is saying we don't think so. Fauci, CDC saying, well, that doesn't square with the facts. So could we get everybody on the same page about this? It isn't infectious, but if you want to manage fear rather than Ebola, then you could ask people to isolate voluntarily. But it's for fear. It has nothing to do with Ebola.
You know, since this is taking place in New England, you know, it has a little bit of the Paul Revere feel to it. Listen to Casey Hickox talking about what it is she's doing. I mean, yes, she's talking about taking a sort of nature ride here, but she's really sort of laying out the politics of her position on public health.
Casey, how's it feel to be out in the fresh air?
It feels amazing, guys.
Why'd you decide to do it?
You know, because we just wanted to enjoy this beautiful day.
How far are you going?
Not very far. We're about to turn around and go back.
Why this?
No, it's okay.
Why a bike ride?
This is something my partner and I like to do. Since we've moved here, this has been our trail.
Are you afraid with the state police around?
I'm not afraid.
Have you heard anything from your lawyer?
I sure haven't. Nope, we're still waiting to hear from the state of Maine to see what they want to do. I hope that we can continue negotiations and work this out amicably.
Actually, the reporters in that situation aren't as confrontational as I would have expected.
They seem pretty supportive of her, in fact, right? I mean, you're sort of getting this, oh, you know, we see you're out this way. I think some in the media are starting to understand, some, that she isn't an infection risk, that she is, in a way, making a statement to try and calm people to say, look, I'm healthy, I tested negative, I don't have any symptoms, you can't get anything from me. She's trying in her way not only to assert her rights, but I think to counteract this fear-mongering that we've seen go on from some of the government officials. By the way, it's interesting. You know, probably 50 of them have come back to this country and are wandering the geography. No one covered them. I mean, they've been coming back. I had two of my own students come back from Liberia who no one did a story about. So if there were infection, I think we'd be seeing the outcome of that already. That aside, I'm afraid I don't think she's going to get what she wants from this, if you will, demonstration or trying to be a spokesperson for the science. I see polls, 80%, 85% of Americans want quarantine. They're afraid of this disease. The fear is big. It may be lost.
The ethics of taking a calm and measured view of quarantine. Arthur Kaplan is the head of the Division of Medical Ethics at the NYU Langone Medical Center. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
So Casey Hickox says, leave me alone. I'm not a threat to anyone. When have you said, leave me alone, or defied authority in some way? From Hendersonville, North Carolina, I worked in the juvenile justice system. The one time that stands out is when one boy's mother was committed to a mental hospital, and I was ordered to deliver him to juvie because he was an incorrigible. I took him home instead and ended up adopting him.
This is Eli from Austin, Texas. I try to disobey authority every chance I get, but in particular, I can remember in my senior year of high school, I left early because I had a work release, and a teacher who didn't know anything about me assumed that I was walking out just because it was the last day. I tried to explain to her, but she wouldn't listen, and I just started walking out the door. She yelled, if you walk out that door, I'm making sure you don't walk at graduation. I looked at her, waved, and walked out. I really didn't want to walk across the stage anyway, but walking out that door sure felt liberating.
Liberation for Eli there. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE with your story. Find us at facebook.com/thetakeaway. One of the holiest sites for Jews and Muslims in Jerusalem reopened in time for Friday morning prayers after Israeli authorities rescinded a rare order to take control of the site over the Arab religious officials who have controlled it for decades. The site of the Temple Mount to Jews and the Haram al-Sharif to Muslims was closed after Israeli police shot and killed a Palestinian man, a suspect in an assassination attempt on a Jewish activist. For more on this, we're joined by Noga Tarnopolsky, who's senior Israel and Palestine correspondent for the Ground Truth Project and Global Post. Noga, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you very much.
So I was listening there a moment ago. There's actually shooting in your neighborhood. You're very near to where everything's going on.
I am very near. I'm especially near to where both the attempted assassination and then the killing of the suspect took place. It's literally in my neighborhood. And what we were hearing before were the sounds of these kind of fireworks or petards that are being sent off as part of the protests.
And the protests are coordinated with Friday prayers?
It's hard to say right now. Yes, they're associated with the Friday prayers, and I don't know if you just heard that.
Yes.
Fatah, that is the party of Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas, called for a day of rage today. I don't think that's a direct order from him or anything, but his party. And so there's really a lot of push among extremists on both sides, I have to say, for a confrontation. And it's terrible to see that.
Does this have echoes of the historic event when the late Ariel Sharon actually went to the Temple Mount and acted as though he was actually taking control of the Temple Mount? And that, of course, spawned violence years ago.
Yeah, of course it does. I'm not sure he acted as if he were taking control. He simply went up there and strolled there. And that point is really important if we want to try and understand the maybe impossible to keep status quo in Jerusalem. In other words, this teeny tiny square that you referred to as Haram al-Sharif for Muslims and the Temple Mount for Jews, Jews basically don't have access to go up and pray there, despite the fact that it's adjacent to the Western Wall of the Temple and it's the most holy site for any religious Jew, without doubt. And that's part of a very difficult status quo that's been developed in Jerusalem, in which Jews have access to one place, Muslims have access to another. And as things have gotten more and more tense, mutual access has really been reduced. What has happened is that extremists have really hijacked the argument.
Is there any initiative on the part of the Israeli government to attempt to negotiate some sort of orderly access?
It's ironic because especially such a right-wing government that likes to claim over and over again that Jerusalem is the eternal and unified capital of the Jewish state seem to have relinquished control over their own capital city and over Jerusalem and really handed it over almost hook, line, and sinker to these very extremist factions who right now, I think, are putting the city and possibly more than just the city in danger.
Noga Tarnopolsky is a senior Israel and Palestine correspondent for the Ground Truth Project and Global Post, reporting for us today from the Abu Tor neighborhood, which is very near to the Temple Mount and the Haram al-Sharif. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
So bourbon and bluegrass might have distracted our indefatigable D.C. correspondent Todd Zwillick on the road all this week down south and yesterday in the state of Kentucky, but it didn't. He found that when you get away from the rallies and the shrimp and ham hors d'oeuvres and spend time in coal country and places where real Kentuckians live, you discover a broad and wide discontent about the economy.
On a flattened hilltop near Centertown, a huge conveyor belt carries western Kentucky coal from deep in the ground and drops it onto a black mountain on the surface. This is the Armstrong Kronos Mine, home to about 320 workers.
Ricky Hook. I'm a mechanic. We do everything. It doesn't matter, electrical, mechanical, whatever.
Not one of these miners, including Ricky Hook, is under any illusions about what their rural community would be like without Kronos.
Without this, it'll be a ghost town. You know, so many people. It's not just the people that work in the mines. think about all the people that supply us with stuff, you know, the roof bolts, all of the stuff that we get, you know, come from factories, and those people have to have a job also. You know, if we don't have coal mining around here, it'll just be a ghost town.
It is an industry under threat. There are only about 12,500 people employed in mining and its supply industries now. That's the lowest in 85 years. Mining has been in decline for two decades or more because of competition from other energy sources and environmental regulations. Miners' numbers are dwindling, but they do make good money, and they vote. And what that means is that candidates like five-term Republican Senator Mitch McConnell and Democratic challenger Allison Lundergan Grimes do plenty of mining of their own for support. And they both dig deep to show who's a better friend of coal. But at least among the pickup trucks parked outside the Kronos mine at the shift change, you hear a lot of ambivalence about both of those candidates. And it's not apathy. Miners are highly skeptical of the EPA. President Obama is extremely unpopular here. They just seem underwhelmed.
They have a big impact on what we do, but neither one of them care. I mean, they ain't showed any of us anything. I mean,
that's Nathan Morris. He's 23, and he's a pin man who works to keep the roof of the mine secure.
Trying to pick one of lesser two evils. I ain't seen Allison Graham really try to do anything at all, and Mitch McConnell, he really ain't impressed us much. So,
McConnell and Grimes are in something close to a dead heat in Kentucky. They go at it in countless TV commercials and in daily rallies. McConnell campaigned this week with a few popular Republicans like junior Kentucky senator and possible presidential candidate Senator Rand Paul. But away from the rallies, Kentucky feels a lot different.
Ronald Smith.
This is the Kentucky Career Center in Louisville. It's where jobless people come to find out about unemployment benefits and about Connect. That's Kentucky's version of the Affordable Care Act. It's about as different an atmosphere as you can get from a campaign rally.
I've never been in this situation before. I'm going to call my name.
I ran into Leslie in the waiting area. She didn't want to give her last name. She just lost her job at a car loan company and is unemployed for the first time in her adult life. And when Leslie lost her job, she also lost her health coverage.
It's gone. So now, you know, and I do, I'm a person that has asthma, as a matter of fact, and I can't even afford to get the stuff that I need for myself, rather less any of my kids who may get sick. So it's pretty rough.
Just outside the unemployment center, Tiffany, who also didn't want to give her last name, says she paid very little attention to the debate over Obamacare and Connect until last week, when she was laid off after 16 years working at a major health insurance company.
It's kind of like a new era. You hear about it, you see it on the news, but it's kind of like an NA. It's not applicable to you until it becomes applicable. And then you kind of have to find out what is Kentucky Care, what is Obamacare, what is Kentucky Connect. So it doesn't apply to you until it applies to you.
And now it applies to you.
Now it applies to me.
Kentucky's unemployment rate in September was 6.7%. That's a bit above the national average. All of the uncertainty and apprehension at the coal mine and at the unemployment center might make you think things are pretty bad overall in Kentucky. Well, not everywhere. This is Kelvin Cooperage on the outskirts of Louisville. Workers are assembling solid oak staves into barrels. Those barrels are toasted and then lit on fire on the inside for a charcoal coating that helps give bourbon its flavor. Bourbon barrels have to be new, but Scotch barrels in Europe don't. So Kelvin does a two-way trade. Make new barrels for Kentucky bourbon, then buy the used barrels back and resell them overseas. Paul McLaughlin is Kelvin Cooperage's vice president, standing in an empty warehouse where all the barrels have been sold.
Business is great right now. It's booming. Bourbon and whiskey in general are booming all over the world. So we've seen a huge increase in demand for the used barrels. We've also seen a huge kind of growth out of nothing of this craft distilling segment. 5 or 6 years ago, there weren't a lot of craft distillers around, and their growth has been incredible. So now, for example, today we're making smaller barrels for craft distilleries, and we're shipping them to just about every state you can imagine.
Kelvin has around 90 workers, and McLaughlin says he's been affected by the delays in implementing Obamacare's employer mandate. He doesn't like all the uncertainty, but as we walk back into the workshop, McLaughlin tells me that business is so good that at least for the business, the election seems remote.
Yeah, from a business standpoint, it doesn't mean much. But, you know, from a personal standpoint and just as a citizen, yeah, obviously it means a lot.
But ultimately, Kelvin's barrels only sell if there's plenty of business for Kentucky bourbon.
Well, business is phenomenal. It's amazing.
That is Bill Samuels, a retired self-described gadfly who spent 36 years as president and CEO of Maker's Mark Distillery.
Well, business is phenomenal. It's amazing. We've been waiting about 230 years for this. It's been a slow come,
yeah.
But it seems real.
Participating to the tune of $3 billion a year now, according to a recent industry report. Most big distilleries are corporate-owned these days, but employment in Kentucky's bourbon industry has doubled over the last couple of years and is expected to double again. Pretty much every distiller in the state is putting up big money to expand.
Well, we're not a normal small business. I mean, with the boom.
Samuel says he has strong personal opinions about the Affordable Care Act, and Maker's Mark is just the kind of business that should be worrying about it right next to an election. But it's not, because they're making too much money.
Well, we worry about it because it affects business, but it's not the most important thing on our plate right now.
This is Todd Zwillick in Louisville, Kentucky, for The Takeaway.
And now we have a story about a disease that is not infectious, a disease that draws the uninfected closer, in fact. When a cancer survivor stands up to cancer, there are family members standing there with them. And we want you to meet some of the family members of the women we've been following in our breast cancer series, Under Her Skin.
Hi, my name is Demetrius Johnson. I am the daughter to Lisa Eccles. And I just wanted to give you all an insight on how women that have breast cancer, what the children and the young women feel, you know, knowing that their mother has breast cancer.
Demetrius Johnson is 25, and for all of those 25 years, her mother's presence was as immovable as a rock, a mountain even. And then she got the news that her mother, Lisa Eccles, had cancer.
The automatic thing that I thought was, I'm about to lose my mother. And being a young woman whose mother is your best friend, not only just your best friend, but she wears so many hats. You can go to her for labs. You can go to her for serious talks. You can go to her for business. And you can go to her just for the comfort of being around her, just to feel, you know, that love. To know that that could be snatched away from me. It was very, very hurtful.
But Demetrius discovered that even those feelings were selfish. If she wanted to hold on to her mom, she would have to step up and be the caregiver to the most important person in Demetrius's life.
The next time that I felt any pain was getting a photograph sent to my phone of my mother, and she had no hair. And that absolutely hurt, because my mother has long, thick, charcoal hair. I've never known my mother's hair to be short, ever. So for her not to have any, it took a toll on me. And I told her, since you don't have any hair, do you want me to cut my hair off? And she said, no, I'm fine. If that's something that you want to do, then do it. But you don't have to, I'm fine. And I realized, Bob is beautiful, and she's beautiful. And she's embraced it, she's smiling. So I have to embrace it and smile. My mother is a fighter, and we were going to fight this battle together.
Family and friends in this fight. We had the pleasure of meeting Doris Johnson, one of cancer survivor Anita Coleman's best friends.
But I've been there, you know, I've been on this last journey with her every step of it, from the moment that she found out to where we are right now.
Doris and Anita made the journey together to New York City. Anita was afraid to fly. Doris secretly is afraid she won't have enough strength for her friend Anita.
I consider myself blessed to be in her presence, because to see a person go through this and you're like, oh, I don't know if I had that strength too, because it's not easy. It's not even just It's just not easy. And before, I didn't realize, you know, and it's when they say, oh, I got cancer treatment, I'm doing this. Ah, what is that? But after going through it, I'm like, okay, there's a whole lot of stuff involved.
Doris says that Anita's willingness to tell everybody her story in her radio diary, even to proudly and playfully yank off her wig and laugh about her bald head as she did one time when we were all standing next to the water looking at the Statue of Liberty, Doris sees this sense of pure peace in her friend.
That's a good thing because it's a positive story. It's her story, and people will see that they can also arrive at the other side. If you're willing to fight for your life, you get there. And some, you know, they need to hear that. You just need to hear good things. At least I do. And I've watched her at her worst, and we've crawled through it together, and then she's ready to go. Okay, let's go.
But how does a father react when he learns that his daughter might be taken by cancer? A daughter passing on before a parent. The worst possible news.
As a minister who has pastored several churches, people would always ask me to pray for them or pray with them. Before I do, I usually would make one request of them, and that is that when my time come, that they would please remember me. You see, if you live long enough in this world, you would discover that everyone gets a turn. Well, my turn came 2 days before Christmas, December the 23rd, 2013.
It was the day Keith Miller learned that his 28-year-old daughter, Crystal Miller, was diagnosed with breast cancer.
I don't have a problem telling you that for a brief moment, my faith was shaken. When no one was around, I cried. I cried in my car. I cried in my room. I cried on my bed. The tears would just come out of nowhere. Every time I traveled from my home in Delaware to Mount Sinai, New York, to be with her during her treatments, a few tears would come out of nowhere. Seeing my baby, my daughter, taking chemo and losing her hair was very difficult. The lump removal, the radiation treatments that followed didn't make it any easier. Being with her during treatments taught me a few things.
It was also during those treatments that Keith realized that while his daughter had support, himself, his wife, Crystal's two brothers, many of the women showing up for chemotherapy and radiation were all alone.
What I take away from this experience of watching these women go through treatment is that having a support system is one of the most important steps to healing. I just want to tell all of those who may be going through that, you're never alone. To my daughter and all the daughters out there, I dedicate this song found on YouTube by songwriter Shannon Sanders. And I hope that everyone will get a chance to see and hear it.
You'll always be daddy's little girl. Yes, you will. Yes, you will. Yes, you will. You'll always be daddy's little girl. Yes, you will. Yes, you will.
Our thanks go out to Keith Miller, Demetrius Johnson, and Doris Adams for joining us in this journey alongside Crystal, Lisa, and Anita. To hear more from our series, visit us at thetakeaway.org and click on Under Her Skin on the right side of the page. You can also join the conversation online by joining our Under Her Skin group on Facebook.
Only one word's best for you, someday you see.
In the age-old battle of the high school jocks and the geeks, the athletes and the math whizzes, this division of high school has been the storyline of many a coming-of-age movie. But for one of our next guests, the jocks have won, and it's not a good thing.
From where I sit, both as a parent and professional, in so many of these high schools, the high school sporting culture has essentially taken over the main mission of the high school.
That's sociologist Earl Smith. He's the author of Race, Sport, and the American Dream. He takes the position that the emphasis on high school sports and the ever-present but outlandish dream of making it to the pros is the worst thing possible for lower-income students. But postdoctoral researcher Daniel Bowen says there's just no data to support that.
There's a lot of reason to believe that school-sponsored sports actually can prove beneficial on the academic end schools that emphasize sports have high participation rates and actually have higher winning rates actually are more successful on academic outcomes, such as test scores and graduation rates.
Daniel Bowen works with the Kinder Institute for Urban Research at Rice University in Houston, Texas.
It seems as if there might be a social capital aspect to sports. As a high school teacher myself, I actually got just as much, if not more, accomplished meeting with parents at high school football and basketball games than I would at a parent-teacher conference, because I could often meet up and run into parents and students who I oftentimes wouldn't get a chance to speak with during school hours.
Earl Smith, can sports and academics coexist in the current environment?
It depends on the school itself. A lot of this depends on socioeconomic status of the communities in which these schools exist. A good portion of the curriculum, and especially in under-resourced minority high schools, specifically African-American high schools, sports is promoted as a way to move these young men, more so than women, off into these colleges that need them as athletes. I mean, these college programs wouldn't exist if these kids weren't coming out of high school. So there's a symbiotic relationship between these high schools and colleges. And once you understand what kind of academic curriculum a lot of these high schools have, you would come away asking some serious questions about whether or not things like social promotion are taking place, how much of the high school GPA is actually legitimate education, what type of support programs exist in these high schools as opposed to not existing in other high schools. And at the end of the day, as a college professor for the last 30 plus years, I've seen the rise in remedial courses at the college level, English, reading, math, which I think tells us something about the type of education that's taking place in high school.
Considering the alternatives for some of these students in these under-resourced communities, you know, isn't this better than the alternative?
Not if the outcomes are poor. You know, we can keep these kids around for 4 or 5 years in high school. We can keep them around in college for 5 or 6 years. And at the end of their eligibility, it's over. There's no outcome. There's no positive outcome. They may, you know, you got a couple of trophies, you got a couple of fake rings, but you don't have anything that moves you into the future. And you got to remember, we're talking about kids at that point who are 22, 23 years of age, who have the rest of their life in front of them. Much of the education that these kids receive is vacuous.
Daniel Bowen, your response.
I think that's extremely harsh to say that students, especially ones who go through maybe even sports-emphasized programs, come out with nothing. They just come out with empty trophies. There's been lots of research to suggest that students who participate in sports develop in areas such as leadership, as well as in a wide range of areas that are often referred to as non-cognitive skills that have real benefits and have been shown experimentally to produce outcomes that are beneficial to people's long-term life outcomes. They actually did a randomized control trial in Chicago with school-sponsored sports programs and showed that students didn't necessarily significantly benefit in terms of academic achievement, in terms of test scores, but they did benefit in terms of their likelihood of not dropping out, persisting, and demonstrating skills that do, in fact, have long lifetime economic benefits.
Again, I appreciate knowing that these things are taking place and people are trying to measure them, but you really can't measure them. We throw around these terms like leadership, the guys run out on the field, they whoop it up with their teammates, they're in the huddle, they're really exerting leadership. Bunk. That's not leadership. High school test scores are important. You look across the world, the U.S. sinks lower and lower and lower when measured against other industrialized nations. As I said before, you come to the college, Yale, Harvard, Princeton, all these colleges that we would put in the top 10 list as being the selective places that we would like our own kids to go, they're offering remedial classes. Who's in the remedial classes? The guys who play football and basketball. They're in those courses. And where do these people go to work? These are the same people who end up unemployed, underemployed, who end up in prison, et cetera, et cetera.
Daniel, does organized sports contribute to the need for remedial education programs at the college level in your research?
There is nothing to suggest that there's a causal relationship between the existence of sports and remedial education. We can't say for a fact that if these individuals had not participated in sports that they would not be in remedial education, because in many cases, those students wouldn't be in those universities in the first place. So you can't necessarily say that X caused Y in this particular instance. Also, to just dismiss some of these measures as being bunk, such as the leadership one, I mean, there's statistical evidence that these individuals are voting in higher rates. They're volunteering more in their community. They're taking active roles. To just kind of dismiss this as nonsensical and relying on anecdotal evidence is more nonsensical, in my opinion.
All right, Earl and Daniel, I want to end on this point here. Should high school coaches be academically affiliated in a high school program? Daniel, you begin.
I do worry sometimes about extreme cases of, you know, coaches who maybe are given a subject area, and you often hear stories of them kind of shirking their responsibilities because they're divided. But again, there is data to suggest that this isn't necessarily the case. I'm actually working on a paper right now with a couple colleagues, and we systematically go throughout the entire state of Florida and see if there's a relationship between coaches and subsequent student outcome. And we don't find that coaches are any better or any worse than other teachers.
Here's what it's a hindrance on: the budget. Too many of these high schools that want to be in the AAA or, you know, gazillion A conference, they've gone out and they have hired gunslingers to come in and coach their teams who have nothing to do with the academic mission of the school. They sit in the office, they work recruiting, they do all this other film studies for their teams, but they don't teach. When I went to high school, every coach was a certified teacher in the high school, even if they taught gym. You look at the scoreboards at these high schools, they're advertising Nikes and Coke and McDonald's. It's become a commercial enterprise just under the level of what you see at the colleges. And so now you have these paid coaches who don't work in the school showing up at 2 or 3 o'clock in the afternoon to coach the sport.
Earl Smith is a sociologist and author of Race, Sport, and the American Dream. And Daniel Bowen is a postdoctoral fellow at the Kinder Institute for Urban Research at Rice University. To hear an extended version of this interview and to hear even more sparks fly, visit our website at thetakeaway.org or sign up to download our daily podcast. Just visit the iTunes store and type in The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. Have a great weekend. This is The Takeaway.
PRI, Public Radio International.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Jeffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.